Welcome to Post Carbon Radio. On Post Carbon Radio, we cover the climate crisis from a range of perspectives centered on Northern California. Climate change is the ultimate interrelated issue, so we include news and perspectives on clean and dirty energy, the economy, social justice, and even war and peace. We want to both inform and inspire you by connecting you to people, movements, and new ideas about climate change from around the world and right here in West Marin. We're on the second and fourth Mondays of the month, and today's program is on agriculture and the climate, how your personal choices affect the planet's future. And in the studio, our guest today is Xenia Spate, who is a community activist for many years and is currently working on the steering committee and climate diet team at 350marin.org and lives and works in Southern Marin as a gardener.
And that was Bing Gong, my co-host. I'm Cara Nyhus, your co-host of Post Carbon Radio today. We are also joined in the studio by Emily Olson. Emily is a food and justice-focused, compassion-centered climate activist who chairs 350 Marin's climate diet team and sits on 350 Marin's steering committee. Joined by eight other core organizers, Emily works to mobilize public awareness around how dietary choices can empower us to heal the planet and transform our global and local food systems. She has a master's in political economy, sustainable development, environmental politics — that's a long title — from UC Santa Barbara, and a deep-rooted reverence for nature as a Marin local. She plans on taking her passionate pragmatism with her to the Paris Climate Summit in December to collaborate with other changemakers, and we will definitely be talking about the COP in Paris toward the end of this hour. We will also be starting a new tradition on Post Carbon of reading a climate events calendar toward the end of the hour. So get your smartphones, your smart pencils, whatever you're going to be using, ready, because we and our guests will be making some announcements. So welcome, Xenia and Emily.
Thank you. It's good
Thank
to be here.
Thank you so much.
Why don't we start off just by telling us a little bit about 350.org and how you're affiliated with
Sure. Group. Mm-hmm. 350 Marin was formed about 2.5 years ago. It's a chapter of 350 Bay Area. And 350.org was founded around 2006 or 2007 by a teacher and his students in Vermont, and spread worldwide to include hundreds or even thousands of communities. Is responsible for the largest turnout on any issue globally, most widespread turnout on any issue. This is a growing movement, and we're happy to have formed a chapter in Marin and look forward to building and doing lots
of
things. And
so what does 350 mean?
So 350 refers to the scientifically agreed upon amount of safe atmospheric carbon dioxide. So basically, this is the safe threshold that scientists say that life can thrive at, right? And unfortunately, you know, being that climate change is at where it's at right now, climate catastrophe, we're above 400 parts per million. You're above 400 parts per million. So we drastically need to close that gap between that to get back to a place where ecosystems around the world and our human communities as well can you know, thrive, and there can be self-supporting life.
And we chose the name, or people chose the name 350.org, because it had a universal power as a number and not a name connected to a certain language. So easily became an international movement that way. 350, like Emily says, refers to carbon dioxide, but we're concerned with all the greenhouse gases, the top three: methane, carbon dioxide, and nitrous oxide.
And there's some controversy at the COPs, the UN climate negotiations. They're just talking about 2 degrees centigrade, but I think 350.org will get us down to 1.5 is what where most environmentalists that I talk to say we need to be, because we're already seeing such drastic climate change with just a 1 degree rise, I think.
And, and you know, in Bolivia, where Bing and I met at the People's Climate Conference, the Bolivian leadership has been calling for that as a threshold because they're already seeing their water supply disappearing, their glaciers, for example. And so for them, 2 degrees is already bad news, and they don't accept that as a target. So today we're following on the Farm and Food Shed Report, which is one of our favorite sister programs, and we understand that Robin was talking about food, so we're going to be talking about food today. And while we don't want to pretend that climate change is just a personal problem, what we are trying to do is empower our listeners to, you know, make what choices and changes we all can to contribute in our daily lives along with the other activism that we choose to do in the world. So we're going to focus on animal agriculture today, is that right?
Yep, we certainly are.
All right. So my understanding of animal agriculture is that we're talking mainly about meat and dairy. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Meat, dairy, and eggs.
Okay, eggs. Don't forget the eggs. Oh, you're not going to leave me with anything. So tell us, why are meat, dairy, and eggs bad for the climate?
They have a huge greenhouse gas footprint that needs to be addressed.
So as we talked about earlier, so, you know, up until this point, both 350.org and 350 Marin have largely focused on the fact that we need to drastically reduce carbon dioxide in our atmosphere. Well, there's two other really important greenhouse gases that are drastically contributing to this accelerating climate change, and those are methane and nitrous oxide. So why do we care about those, and why are we talking about this in terms of our work with the Climate Diet Team? Well, methane is 20 times more impactful on temperature than carbon dioxide. And it's also in such great quantity. We have, you know, more methane in our atmosphere now than we've had in over 800,000 years of our existence on this planet. And in addition to that, you know, we can also think about nitrous oxide, which is 296 times more potent than carbon dioxide. So methane and nitrous oxide, even though they're in lesser quantity than carbon dioxide and they're not talked about as much, when we look at how potent they are comparatively, that's a big deal. And I think methane's really important to talk about, and why it comes up for us is because with animal agriculture, you know, there's billions of animals that are implicated in this process. Mm-hmm. And billions of animals that are respiring. You look at the long supply chain of animal agriculture, transportation, raising these animals, feeding them, that it adds up, right? It adds up even though there's, you know, comparatively less carbon dioxide.
And so let's talk about the dairy part of it.
Sure. Well, dairy doesn't escape some attention. It is, one, not healthy to consume dairy as a human being. We're not baby cows. And it's harmful to the cows and their calves. And it can also contributes to incredible use of water. I think it takes 30 gallons of water per day for the dairy cows. And their waste excrement is huge. Emily, you may have some of those facts in front of you, but
yes.
So anyway, the dairy is a big problem. No other species consumes the milk of another species.
Wait, can I just say, because I remember in seventh grade biology class growing up and hearing that milk was the perfect food, that it has proteins, vitamins, and hydration. So what's wrong with that? And don't kids need milk to grow up strong?
Well, the milk you buy in the store, they add calcium and vitamin D to it to make a claim that it's a good, healthy food. Actually, what they add does not mimic nature's vitamin D and calcium. So there have been studies that show that drinking dairy milk causes osteoporosis. It doesn't build strong bones like the dairy industry claims.
You probably don't have studies right at hand about that information.
They're widely available.
Okay.
Well, let me put in a word about our local dairy, Strauss Dairy. It's organic, and from what I hear, they're very sustainable. He uses the methane to digester, to use the gas to run his vehicles and electricity. I don't know. What do you say to that?
Well, I'd like to see his numbers. I'd like to see his inputs. Where does the feed come from? You can't graze dairy cows like you can graze beef cows. They're confined much of their life being milked. So there's got to be inputs, both in terms of feed, you know, the land it takes to grow the feed is bigger than the land that they're living on. They use, like I said, a tremendous amount of water and energy.
I think we're talking about different scales. I think primarily, from what I understand, the harm of agriculture is the industrial scale. And farmers, I think, locally are more smaller dairies and maybe don't confine their cows so much, and they're pasture-fed.
Yeah, well, actually, cows raised for moving to the beef area, there are many farms that claim to be sustainable in raising their cattle for beef. They actually live longer lives. They live 23 months instead of 15 months. So that's 8 additional months of having to use the land, feed them, use water, and absorb the excrement on a daily basis. So it's actually more unsustainable in terms of those impacts than the factory farms in terms of land use, the time it takes to raise and slaughter these beautiful creatures.
Emily, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I mean, getting back to the environmental impact of the dairy industry, I mean, put some figures out in this conversation, for 1 gallon of milk, it takes 1,000 gallons of water, okay? And this is really important for us to contextualize in terms of the drought in California, okay? The drought in California basically is climate change coming to our backyard. It's apparent that climate change is not something that's existing out there or existing just in faraway communities, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, you know, other places where the COP talks have been taking place, right? This is something that is very local. It's becoming increasingly localized that we're experiencing on a day-to-day basis. And if we're thinking about water use, we can also think about the fact animal agriculture takes 47% of our state's total water usage. Okay, so dairy is contributing to that significantly.
So I can imagine that some of our listeners may have questions about the numbers that are being cited here. And we know you're not, you know, you're not book authors and you're not the authors of the studies. But if somebody was a skeptical listener and they wanted to follow up on this conversation and find some research studies, where would you where did you get your information and where would you recommend that people go to check on that?
Yeah, so a lot of the resources that we refer to, you know, Water Footprint Network is one for the statistic I just mentioned, for example, about 1,000 gallons of water for 1 gallon of milk. Also, the UN Food and Agriculture Organization has put out several studies over the past few years. One place that does a really great job of consolidating different statistics on the impact of animal agriculture specifically related to climate change is Cowspiracy.com. So for any of the listeners who are unfamiliar with what Cowspiracy is, it's a documentary that came out this past year, and it really highlights how a lot of environmental organizations, even including our own 350.org, have largely failed to address animal agriculture's impact on climate, even though a UN report in 2006 explicitly said that animal agriculture is one of the top 2 to 3 contributors to the worst environmental problems at every scale, whether you're talking globally, regionally, or locally.
And for our listeners, 2006, that would have been the AR3 report from the UN process.
So, which said that 18% of the greenhouse gases is contributed by animal agriculture.
Is that globally?
Globally.
Okay.
Followed up later by another study by researchers from the World Bank, which made a claim, well, if you include the respiration of the animals and the clear cutting of the forests, and I believe, I could be wrong on this, but the waste problem, that it actually would increase to over 50%, 51% is what they said. Now, the numbers can be a little bit different depending on what factors you bring in. But
exactly.
The point is that it is a significant impact, and we have to face it as a species.
Okay, Emily.
Yeah, and to piggyback off of what Jenya just said about, you know, that range between 18% and 51%, I know that, you know, listeners may be thinking, well, that's quite a big difference between those numbers, right? And, you know, again, this is not a result of bad or inconsistent science. This is how holistic these assessments are. But even if we're only going by that 18% lower end estimate, we need to contextualize this in comparison to other sectors. So when we talk about greenhouse gas contributors, like the main ones, usually we think of energy, we think of agriculture, we think of transportation. So if we compare transportation, which often is associated, right, with the conventional fossil fuels, carbon dioxide, that actually has a lower footprint than animal agriculture.
Yeah, I think I'll just add that for listeners, what you said, Jenya, about bringing in factors that different people do their studies different ways, and they draw the boundary around what sort of is counted as an input or a cost. And so that's why you may get conflicting numbers. And so just to put that out there in general, that climate greenhouse gas quantification is always fraught with that problem. So So we've talked about your views, and I just feel, again, for the listeners' perspective, that our listeners may also have heard of something like The Vegetarian Myth by Lear Keith. And if you haven't, you might want to look at it. There are interviews of her on YouTube, and that is her book. And she is Derek Jensen's partner, is that correct? Or she's associated with him?
She's
anyway.
Associated with him.
Oh.
She was a vegetarian for many years.
Yeah, and had health problems. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to just give you a sense to sort of characterize what her critique is and respond to that if you'd like to.
Yeah, so one thing off the bat. So we, even though neither one of us have read that book, we are very familiar with her core arguments and whatnot. And, you know, we've also listened to several interviews that she has done. And she was actually in 2010 on KPFA, and she explicitly admitted, and you can find this interview archived online, that she binged on dairy and eggs at every opportunity she got, even though she claimed that she was, in fact, not just vegetarian, but she claimed she was vegan for 20 years. So to us, you know, there's a bit of inconsistency there that sort of, for us, creates problematic credibility. But anyway, that aside, if we're looking and going back to her arguments, you know, there are some truths in her arguments in the sense that her critique of modern agriculture, you know, is sound in the sense that we, as a team, we don't promote large-scale monocrop agriculture. We see that this has created a lot of environmental and social consequences for our planet. And we, you know, as part of what we consider sustainable food production system, we want to transition away from that, away from monocrop soy and corn and whatnot. But we think that sort of her targeting specific parts of it is, again, very, very limited and short-sighted. And the nutritional consequences she suffered, you can't tie that directly to a vegetarian or vegan diet if, again, she admitted that she wasn't following that.
She made a claim that we're not cows, we can't eat, we can't digest cellulose, which comes from plant matter. Well, we're not supposed to digest cellulose. Cellulose is basically fiber that helps us digest our food. It helps move things through. It's important. And, you know, it just seemed odd that she would make that statement, not doing her research on health in the body.
All right. Are there any other detractors from your argument that you would like to respond to? Like, what are the major arguments against vegetarianism and veganism, or are there many?
Yeah, so, you know, anyone who has, you know, transitioned to a plant-based diet will say that the most common question they get asked is, where do you get your protein? Or how do you possibly get enough protein? So to respond to that, I like to use this direct comparison. If you look at some strong herbivores out in nature, right, or real-life examples, if you look at a rhinoceros, if you look at an elephant, and whatnot, and you can see they're muscular and they're thriving, they live a predominantly plant-based diet. Right, and they're doing just fine, and you can see that we have tons of resources for getting protein at our disposal that are more effective. They require much less land, right? So again, if we're looking again at sort of the implications for our planet, right, in addition to the implications for our health, you know, there are so many readily available resources there.
Emily's right, and you know, we do require protein in our diet, 8 essential amino acids.
I do anyway.
Yeah. And all plants contain the 8 essential amino acids and other amino acids, depending on the plants, and vegetables and fruits and nuts and seeds and legumes. There is adequate, more than adequate, nutrition available to us switching over to a plant-based diet.
Okay. Yeah. We'll get back to that a little bit in a little while. But I want to step back up to the organizational level and talk about the sort of strategy of 350 Marin and why the climate diet team exists, what your goal is.
Well, 350 Marin actually has a number of working committees focusing in different areas. I think the problem of climate change is so large, we really have to approach it from different angles simultaneously. So we have a group working on clean energy and fossil fuel resistance. We have a divestment committee trying to encourage the county pension fund and schools and other institutions, churches, to pull their money out of the fossil fuel industry. So there are definitely very important committees that we have working in different ways. Animal agriculture, our committee, the climate diet team, is so important that we had to form a working group to confront that. In terms of what individuals can do, we find just with animal agriculture that this is an easy one. This is a no-brainer. It's very quick and easy for someone to begin to make an impact as an individual, then as a circle of friends, as a community. We're looking to create positive things that people can do to face the crisis.
I have to admit I'm an omnivore, but I recognize the harmful effect of industrial agriculture and cattle and so forth. But I've been trying to – I can't cold turkey going off meat. So what would you recommend for someone like me?
I mean, sure. Go ahead.
Yeah, so part of our group is recognizing that it can be very difficult to make changes to your diet. I mean, for a number of reasons. I mean, for one, there's a lot of it's very culturally entrenched, right? Mm-hmm. It's entrenched in our policy. It's something that is constantly reinforced by the media. But, you know, we meet people where they're at. And part of our work as a committee is to provide resources for people who want to learn more. And, you know, however your pace of transition is, right? The fact that the intention is there, the consciousness to want to do something for yourself and the planet at the same time. So we think it's really important to have that community reinforcement. So we often hold events and whatnot where people can come and directly engage with us, and we can sort of discuss these things. There's a lot of great ways to connect with people throughout the Bay Area, and we inject enjoyment in it too. It's about finding joy. It's not just about sacrificing or giving something up in your diet, right? We're not framing this. Again, what Jenny was saying, it's about saying yes to things as much as it is about saying no when we're taking climate action in our lives. So one thing I'd recommend is, you know, not only taking advantage of the educational resources that are at your disposal and figuring out ways you can adapt that in your own life, but engaging with people who are at different stages in their journey of transition. Some people have been vegans for a while. Some people are still working on it. We all can tap into the experiences we all have, right, and say, I relate to that. I resonate. And then kind of find our own place within that.
And remember that a lot of the delicious flavors that we think of when we're eating animal products come from plants.
The
garlic
onions.
And onions. Yeah, the lemon and the spices. We're not going to miss so much. We actually think of it as an adventure. And if you just want to stick your toe in the water and try it, we encourage that. If you want to jump in full steam, we encourage that. There's room for everybody.
I remember some campaigns a few years ago just asking people to not eat meat, say, one night a week, just to cut back. You know, is that sort of – does that count? Does gradualism matter?
Everything counts. And because Emily was saying how hard it is, or Dean was saying how hard it is to make a transition, if you need to go slow. But find your support in your community to help you on that journey, because there are unhealthy vegan diets, and we don't encourage that. You know, sugar, or there's a lot of junk food that people may start binging on, and there are healthy vegan diets. So find your support system, and we just encourage you to go forward.
Yeah, and I think just knowing your impact, like, over time also gives you further ammunition to continue down your path. And, you know, whether it's increasing your speed and maybe adding an extra night on that you say, okay, now I feel comfortable, I can upgrade a little bit and maybe, you know, not eat meat 2 days a week. But I think it's knowing the power of your impact. You know, for example, just to throw some numbers out there, by eating a plant-based diet for an entire year, you can save 1.5 billion gallons of water. You can save over 50,000 square feet of forest, you can half your carbon footprint, but you can more immediately also save an animal's life every day. But if you look at that for eating a year and you think about how even on a weekly basis or daily basis, how high those numbers would still be comparatively to other activities we engage in, I think it's great to know, again, that there's this harmony between personal choice and collective action, and knowing that you're doing something that's mirrored by a bunch of other people as well. And that does add up.
Yeah, I recognize all those things. And my wife and I, we are trying. She's been experimenting with vegetarian recipes and getting more. And Chinese style, traditionally, they just have a small quantity of meat chopped up into it as a garnish rather than a big slab of meat. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's very much the American way, right? It's not really dinner unless there's a big slab of meat. I've been trying to do that, too. It's just like, if you take a piece of chicken and you slice it up and you put it on the I know they're not looking at me like this is the right thing to do, but it's better. Isn't it better that it's just a little bit of meat?
Yeah, I think this might be a good place to talk about compassion for the animals. And it's not just about us finding a delicious meal, you know, and satisfying our conditioning that we've grown up in. And I'm one. I ate meat for 50 years, you know. I don't feel guilty about it. I just feel more informed now, and I'm helping other people learn some of the health issues and the climate change relationship. But, I think compassion is something that needs to be part of the conversation when it comes to climate change. I mean, think of climate change as this big issue, right? And I'm almost too small to face it. But if we love ourselves, our community, our family, our earth, why not love the animals too? And we don't need to eat them. That's been proven over and over again. It's not clear that we always ate them. In fact, the design of our human bodies is actually more suited for plant-based diet. So why not extend that compassion to all these animals out there? And maybe that'll even change us, you know, in a very deep way, because, you know, there's so much violence in the world and aggression and domination and war. Will our species evolve to another place if we all of a sudden don't have to kill a sentient being?
Yeah. Emily, you wanted to add on.
Yeah, so just to add, you know, to what all the great stuff Jenny was saying, you know, our work in 350 Marin, and really as climate activists in the broader sense, goes beyond drastically reducing greenhouse gases in our atmosphere. Like, that's a nice perk of the work that we're doing. But at the same time, it's really a larger exercise in reimagining and redesigning our relations to one another and, you know, increasing that circle. So it's not just one another in terms of people-to-people interactions, but as Jenny said, all the animals, you know, all the different ecosystems, the biodiversity that we have and that's sadly declining at such a rapid rate as collateral for a lot of human behaviors that we've been engaging in. So, you know, this is really a creative endeavor of transformation. Yeah.
Can I step back and get even a bigger view? For
Please.
Millions of years, or some billions, actually, nature has designed, as Emily is saying, has designed this world to be a sustainable world. Nature has designed it that way. Things have a balance. The atmosphere, the water cycle, the nutrient cycle, the species that coexist and come and go. There is a natural balance over millions of years. Our species has altered that in a matter of a few thousand. And I think now we need to return to be part of nature as a species. That's our challenge right now.
We can't get away from it, actually, can we? No. We are a part of nature, aren't we? Programming on KWMR is also brought to you by the Maritime Radio Historical Society, working to preserve West Marin's rich radio heritage. This nation's last working Morse code coast station is Coast Carbon Radio, and we are in the studio with Zhenya Spake and Emil Olson of Marin350.org, the climate action organization that has gone global. And today we're talking about agriculture and the benefits of a vegetarian and vegan diet. So I want to step back for a minute because, Zhenya, you mentioned compassion for the animals. And Emily, you talked at one point, I can't remember your exact words, but about sort of the benefits to yourself, not just of your health, but feeling good about what you're doing when you're eating a climate-friendly diet. And I want to focus on how doing that has affected your other activism, because I've really noticed in my own activist work that people, you know, what a surprise, people need to feel good. They want to feel good by their actions. And so I want to hear from you. How has going vegan or vegetarian affected your activism? Do you feel better about yourself and therefore you want to go do stuff? Do you feel released of guilt? Do you feel like this compassion is really giving me a kind of energy? How has it affected your other activism?
Yeah, so I'd say it definitely has had spillover into other forms of activism. I mean, for me, it feels really great to know that by virtue of making this choice at least three times a day, you know, I feel like I'm living more consistently in line with sort of my lifelong, or what has been so far my lifelong appreciation for nature. And I feel like it's given me more hope in a lot of ways. It's injected more hope in general for how I view sort of the outcome or the possible outcomes that we could accomplish, you know, in our climate activism on a day-to-day basis. I mean, you know, I really think that even though we talk constantly in terms of, you know, the climate change is a crisis, this is also an opportunity for us. Getting back to what Jen and I were talking about, this is really an opportunity for us to do things differently. And that doesn't just, you know, encompass changing our system of agriculture, right, to a way that's more sustainable and just and ideally more plant-based. But that also means our society and our economy, all these systems, the status quo that's been in place. You know, this is really an opportunity for us to turn things around and get back in touch with nature and be on the same wavelength. And for me, moving forward, I feel like this this has given me that sense, especially being of the younger generation and, you know, knowing that there's a lot of people that are standing and rising up now to be part of this movement.
Great. I'd like to open up the phone lines now. If you'd like to call in and have any questions or comments, you can call in on the studio to 415-663-8492. That's 415-663-8492. And how about telling us, I heard you just had an event last week at the Andrews Soto, I think. Can you tell us a little bit about?
Sure. Go ahead. So it was our first ever community meeting. So we're going to be hosting a series of regular community meetings. We start with a potluck, and then afterwards we feature a prominent speaker, preferably from our local area. And we were so honored to have Andre Soto, who is a very successful and highly prolific Richmond community organizer, come and speak to us about the dangers of crude by rail. And specifically, you know, crude by rail is something that is particularly part of the fossil fuel resistance movement. Crude by rail is happening in our backyard, essentially, in the sense that, you know, these trains that are carrying this highly volatile and you know, dangerous material, it's passing by schools, it's passing by other community outlets, and it is deadly. And Andre Soto was like not only talking about, you know, why this matters to us, but also what we can do to get involved. How can we put an end to this, essentially?
Well, we all know what happened in Canada a couple years ago. I can't pronounce the name.
Lac-Mégantic.
Yeah. Anyway, a runaway train and derailed in Quebec and killed almost 50 people and turned the town into a toxic waste area. And so that's why they call it a bomb train.
Mm-hmm. Accidents are inevitable mm-hmm. with these trains. That's what's been proven so far. And they want to increase the traffic. They want to bring the trains into the Bay Area, into heavily, densely populated, you know, part of our country. We don't want to put our communities at risk. And Andres was very inspiring. I went to the event as well. And, you know, 70 people turned out for this first community meeting we put on the night that the Warriors were playing their final championship game.
That's big.
That alone, it's like, you know what? I think this movement has a chance if people are going to prioritize learning about these issues.
I wasn't aware that there were refineries in San Luis Obispo. So the train would travel through Sacramento, the East Bay, and then through the Central Valley to the refineries in San Luis Obispo. So,
yeah, I don't know the exact routes that they have planned, they'll be here.
But it does
and
raise,
they are here, actually.
It does raise the important point in my mind that, you know, the Keystone XL pipeline is not the only way that oil travels across the country. It's not the only pipeline, and so it's not the only site for affected communities and for us to sort of stop that fossil fuel from being taken out of the ground and the carbon into the atmosphere.
On our last program, we spoke to Diane Weixam, who's in Portland, and they have Daphne Weixam, and they're staging a lot of whole battle against coal, and they want to find ports for natural gas to the market, to China, basically, I guess.
I live in a globalized economy, and almost every community in the world is facing some aspect of, you know, what contributes to climate change, or they're facing the impacts of it with weather changes.
So based on that community meeting, I understand you have another meeting coming up. Is that correct?
Yep. So we do have another meeting coming up in July, and we're still finalizing the details as far as the speaker goes. But specifically, while we were on the point of Andres Soto, there is an action directly related to this topic coming up that we are promoting as 350 Marin. It's going to take place on July 11th. And it's going to take place in Richmond, and it's going to take place as a march and rally commemorating that incident in Canada that was discussed that killed 47 people and displaced many more. And there's going to be a lot of community participation, booths that are set up to say, like, again, the different levels of involvement you can get into if you really care about this issue, you feel, you know, motivated to do something about it and whatnot.
There'll be music and speakers and art, very family-friendly action, and you know, this is important enough to show solidarity across the Bay, so many of us are organizing to go there. Our website will have some transportation information at some point this
week. And what is that website?
350marin.org.
Great. You just helped me update my climate calendar, which, to remind our listeners, we're going to be reading a climate action calendar for the rest of 2015. And I also want to announce that we have another new item this week, which is we've set up an email address that you can use as a listener to Post Carbon Radio to send in suggestions for show ideas, people we should interview, feedback about the shows that we're doing, questions you want asked. And that address is postcarbon@earthlink.net. So there's no hyphen or anything, just postcarbon@earthlink.net. So go ahead and drop us a line and tell us what you think. Also, feel free to send us climate action calendar items, because we do think we will continue to update the climate action calendar. And there are other climate action calendars. We were discussing that before we came in today. So, Emily, you want to let listeners know other places they can look for where to plug in?
Sure. So the Center for Biological Diversity is a great local organization. They're constantly, you know, talking about different ways that you can get involved and, you know, different specific events for you to get involved. Also, People's Climate Train has a Facebook account, and people represented from different organizations frequently are posting what they're up to and encouraging others to come get involved. Mm-hmm. So I highly recommend you check out those resources.
Emily, I understand that you're planning to go to Paris this November, December for the UN climate negotiations. Tell us what you plan to do there, and what are your hopes?
Yeah, so I went on the People's Climate Train back last September. And it was, for those of you who don't know, it was a momentous march organized in large part by 350.org that drew 500,000 people. So that was, yeah, and Bing was there as well. We met on the People's Climate Train, actually. But, you know, that was really a big sort of pulse leading up to sort of this Paris Climate Summit, which is really considered by many climate activists to be the big one, right? The big one that really is decisive. So for me, it was really important to be there one way or another. And, you know, I actually started a Facebook group about climate, like food-focused climate activists. So I'm already, you know, trying to organize international activists that are passionate about this issue or starting to learn about it and whatnot, keeping it very inclusive. And we hope to highlight animal agriculture, obviously, as, you know, one of the pressing areas that we feel that our political leaders, along with other contributors to climate change, need to be talking about and paying attention to. So for me, I want to take part in the civil society forums with many others and essentially, you know, be bringing the facts and calling our leaders to task and, you know, reinforcing the urgency of climate change with, like, solid commitments.
Excellent. Yep. I wish I were going, too.
I think, you know, last year's People's Climate March, 400,000 in New York, there's no coincidence that shortly thereafter, New York bans fracking. The governor signs the bill. And, this just demonstrates the power of the people and that, you know, we shouldn't feel, I know we feel small sometimes, but we should feel like in the end, we need to change this world. We need to form the groups and the movements that have that power to change the world. So I'm so proud of Emily going to Paris, and it's just great. These international talks are important for the conversation globally, for some governments to set their goals and agreements. In the end, what are the solutions? What are the on-the-ground solutions that's going to turn climate change around? Goals and timetables are important, but that's not a solution. That's just pushing a country into doing something. So the conversation then comes back to each country, ours particularly, of what do we do?
And the at the same time, just to speak up for the goals and timetables, that getting countries to agree to binding targets has been the real political challenge, right? That we do have a lot of great solutions.
Very important.
It's just we need political will to force us all to do them.
Especially in this country where the majority of Republicans, I don't think they believe in climate change, and we're at a logjam politically.
Yeah. Well, speaking of political action, I do have a legislative update that at the state level, Senate Bill 185 in California is calling on the big state pension funds, CalPERS and CalSTRS, to divest from coal and presumably all fossil fuels as a next step. Seems that it's going to be harder to get through the assembly, so we don't advocate positions on this bill. But if you have one, you should contact your family assembly representative. So again, that is Senate Bill 185, SB 185, about divesting the big California public pension funds from fossil fuels.
Well, I'm just reading here that Norway, their $890 billion government pension fund. They sold $9 billion worth of coal investments. So the divestment is in the air, I believe.
And I'm proud of my people, Bing.
They're talking, hey, and they're talking decarbonization. I haven't heard that term a lot.
Yeah, that's speaking of binding targets, that's the lingo that I'm starting to hear people talk about is full decarbonization targets, which in a way is great, right, because that's the sustainable world we need to get to. The downside of talking about decarbonization is that it's further in the future. It's 2050, you know, on the tight end. And so that if we only talk about that, that gives political leaders more breathing room to not deal with the binding deadlines that we need in the next years and decades, right?
And it's good to remember that most of these talks are focused on carbon dioxide. Animal agriculture contributes or uses about a third of our energy in the country, which is mainly carbon, mainly from fossil fuels and producing carbon dioxide. But we do need to expand the conversation to include the other greenhouse gases, and I hope that happens at the international level.
Can you just clarify? You said it uses a third of our energy,
mm-hmm.
meaning?
Energy used in the United States.
All energy forms?
All energy forms, I believe, or just fossil fuel energy forms.
Yeah. Not Emily.
Yeah, so to tack on to what Jenny said and also something I neglected to talk about earlier when I was talking about methane and how it's much more potent in the short term than carbon dioxide, it's also important to look at that hopefully in the sense that methane is also easier to reduce in the short term. So it's more potent, but we can also act immediately to reduce its impact and also because it has a shorter lifeline. Yeah, in our atmosphere. And also, you know, Jenny was talking about looking at all the greenhouse gases and nitrous oxide. Okay, that comes from specifically connected to animal agriculture manure. And just to put some perspective on how drastic the whole animal waste issue is and why we should care about that and not just sort of laugh it off, animal waste from animal agriculture activity contributes 130 times more waste than that of the entire U.S. population. So, and that's a big contributor to nitrous oxide, which, again, just as a reminder, is 296 times more potent than carbon dioxide. So decarbonization is a very limiting term for multiple reasons.
Yeah, it's not just clean waste. It's laced with drugs going into all of our waterways. And, yeah.
Emily, do you have one final comment? And then we're going to move to the climate calendar. So listeners, get your pencils, pens, and smartphones ready.
Well, also to talk about what Jenya said, like off of the pollution, I mean, this is a community issue. So it's not just about, again, what we're putting in the atmosphere, but this affects community health as well as planetary health. And, you know, we're talking about all these different climate solutions and connecting through your community. But, you know, if we're looking at, say, again, bringing it back to California, like in the Central Valley, people are suffering. People that live close to these animal agriculture facilities, they're suffering with very tangible health issues. For example, respiratory issues, including asthma from the ammonia, also the antibiotic runoff, nitrogen seepage. So all of these things are very interconnected. We can't really isolate one particular effect or consequence.
Okay. Well, we're not quite done with our listeners, so we're not going to quite say goodbye yet. I mean, sorry, with our guests. But we are going to pause now, and I'm going to read the Climate Action Calendar. And again, I encourage listeners, if you know of some upcoming action for the rest of 2015 that's not on this calendar, send it to us, postcarbon@earthlink.net, and we'll add it to the calendar next time. So this is going to take a while, but that's why we're starting early. Coming up this week, as you may know, June 24th through the 28th, that is Wednesday through Sunday, it is the U.S. Social Forum in San Jose. There has not been a U.S. Social Forum since 2010, and so this is a big deal. It's also happening at the same time in Philadelphia. I will be present. The Green Party is going to be there with a big presence. I don't know if 350 is going to be present.
I don't know.
We're not sure.
Yeah,
okay.
Maybe.
But you can still go. It's a very grassroots political gathering, and it's a rare opportunity at this point. The website is USSFSanJose. It's either .com or .org. They both work. So, again, USSFSanJose.com. In particular, Rising Tide will be presenting a People's Assembly, and there will be many other groups holding workshops. July 5th, which is Sunday, is the Temescal Fair in Oakland. That's a good outreach opportunity for all you climate activists. As Emily mentioned earlier in our show, July 11th is the Lac-Mégantic anniversary, and that will be in Richmond. Does either of you know the exact location of that event? Okay, while you're looking that up, this is about the crude train that exploded. It's Kinder Morgan. Oh, look, a whole flyer. Thank you, Xenia. Stop Oil Trains March Rally in Action, July 11th, Atchison Village Park in Richmond. So I don't see an address, but I'm sure if you Google A-T-C-H-I-S-O-N and Richmond, you'll find it. The hashtag is Stop Oil Trains, so that'll probably also help you find it.
And we might be organizing a bus from Marin,
okay.
Which makes it a lot easier because I think it's just a one-way march, so you don't have to, you know, try to figure out your car situation.
And should people tune into 350marin.org to find out about that?
Yes.
Great. Okay.
350 Marin.
350 Marin.
350 Marin.org. Okay. So July 19th, just 8 days after that, there's Rodeo to Richmond, stop crude by rail. And you can find out about that at Global Exchange's website, globalexchange.org/events. July 19th, Rodeo to Richmond. I'm going to skip some of these events because they're not directly climate related. August 22nd, Our Power Festival on the Richmond Greenway. That's in the planning stages, but that sounds like an energy and environment event. September 4th and 5th, there's going to be a Soil Not Oil conference in Richmond. Go Richmond! Mm-hmm. Richmond has got a lot going on. And they've been visiting the North Bay, not just at your event. They were also in Petaluma talking to us about their organizing method for getting people elected to local office, which has been very powerful and successful for them. Richmond is in the house in the North Bay. Mm-hmm. And September 6th, Climate March, San Francisco. Anybody know more and want to talk about that? That's all I have. Okay, we don't know. Stay tuned. September 6th, get it on your calendar. Emily's got a comment.
Yeah, so there's actually one event coming up next weekend that I wanted to bring to your attention. It's specifically related to our Climate Die team because we're hosting it on Sunday, the 28th. We are going to be hosting a meetup at the Marin Civic Center Farmers Market. It's going to be formatted like a picnic, and it's a great opportunity to meet our individual committee members and to find out more about this issue and ask questions and also be engaged and find out about the specific projects that we're doing around this issue.
From 11 to 1.
Yep.
Yeah. 11 to 1, Marin Farmers Market. And that's at the Civic Center?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Flood the System and Rising Tide. In the first week of September, there will be some events called Flood the System. We don't have times or places yet. The Pope is coming to the United States on September 20th. And the Pope has made some strong statements about climate. So keep tuned on that. October 2nd, Stanford University is doing a climate action rally. October 2nd, don't have a location. October 10th to 11th is the Eco-Socialist Conference in Santa Barbara. I went to one of those when it was in Oakland. Those are great. Hmm. October 10th and 11th. November 30th through December 11th, we know that's the COP, and Emily will be there representing for all of us. Okay. I have a couple more. The group that put together this calendar actually is planning solidarity events in the Bay Area around the COP. So if you're not traveling to Paris, but you are an activist and you want to plug in and help put the pressure on all around the world, like 350 does, there are planning meetings coming up. The first one just happened a week or two ago, and the next one is going to be July 9th from 7 to 9 p.m. in Oakland at the California Nurses Association. They have an office at 2000 Franklin Street. So again, that's July 9th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the California Nurses Association, 2000 Franklin Street in Oakland. That's for people who, you know, are with organizations that want to work in a coalition to plan actions around the next UN climate meeting. There's all kinds of details that I don't have time to read on the air. Jenny, you have a comment?
Well, we're going to be fully engaged in that, and probably going to be organizing some kind of a springboard event either a week or 2 weeks prior to build towards the larger Bay Area.
Great.
Demo.
Yeah. So maybe that's a good time. I'm going to first remind listeners, if you didn't hear something and you know of a great event, send it to us at postcarbon@earthlink.net. If you have comments, questions, or show ideas, send it again, postcarbon@earthlink.net. And let's just wrap up now and make sure that listeners know how to get in contact with you to plug in to 350 Marin. So, and let's also mention again what your main working committees are, what issues people could plug in around.
Committees that we have formed right now are around divestment, fossil fuel resistance, animal agriculture's connection to the climate, and
clean energy.
And the clean energy.
So
it's a very strong committee.
Yeah. Can you say like one sentence to describe what each of those is to make crystal clear what we're talking about?
Well, clean energy is promoting a shift over from fossil fuel to solar and other renewable energy sources.
With a lot of inspiration coming from Mark Jacobson's Solutions Project. So we're calling for a 100% shift to renewable energy within the next few
Decades. We talked about the divestment one a little bit earlier in the show. We did approach the county's MSARA retirement agency, and they basically ignored us, even though about 15 of us spoke out in the open time. And we'll be going to the supervisors on that. And the fossil fuel resistance join us on the marches in the East in Richmond. And then come sit with us and have some good, delicious food this Sunday, the 28th, at the Farmers Market Civic Center.
Okay, well, I'd like to thank you, Emily Olson and Xenia Spake of 350 Marin, for joining us on Post Carbon Radio. Thank you for all your good work.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
You can listen to all our archived Post Carbon Radio programs at wmpostcarbon.com.
Great.
I'm trying to spread the word about this immense issue, but I find it absurd why so many people are confused. Some people don't understand the weight of this problem. Act now before it gets out of hand, cause Earth is calling. I was 10 years old, exposed to it. The inconvenient truth really made me concerned how it was going to affect the youth. The temp is still rising from the pollution we produce. We need to start striving for a solution to reduce. When we burn fossil fuels like coal and gasoline, we're using dirty energies when we should be using clean. When we burn, we're adding to the greenhouse effect. CO2, CH4, and N2O collect in our atmosphere. They remain up there for years and years, absorbing sun rays that come near. But we need to persevere, cause this makes our planet's temp rise fast. So why can't we find a way to cut back on our greenhouse gas?
We have waited too long. Act now before the moment's gone. The situation's tough, but stay strong until we see the dawn.
The climate's on my mind, the climate's on my mind. Climate's on my mind, the climate's on my mind. The climate's on my mind, the climate's on my mind. The climate's on my mind, the climate's on my mind.
The most abundant greenhouse gas is carbon dioxide, beats a methane, nitrous oxide, and the F gases by landslide. Everyone releases it when they drive, unless you have an electric ride. It's almost 400 parts per million, and the main reason for climate's rise. Deforestation makes it worse when the trees decay. CO2 dispersed, also dead trees can't breathe it in. Makes it harder to cut back our emissions. Temperature is on the rise, all other animals can blame us, because we are where the fault lies, and it's coming back to maim us. Rising climate poses many problems to the human race. Extreme weather like Katrina and Haiyan we'll have to embrace. The glaciers are melting and the sea level's rising at a fast pace. People living on the coast are going to be displaced. Certain species extinct, less water to drink. Other areas too wet, floods a big threat. Other areas dry out, susceptible to drought.